Welcome to Divorce Explained, the podcast where we answer your questions and navigate the process of divorce together. Sharing real stories and personal experiences, this is your guide through it all. With your hosts, family law specialist Steve Benmore and divorce lawyer and strategist Leanne Townsend.
To our viewers, we are talking about abuse today, but not one that you would think may be the subject of a group of family lawyers discussing abuse. Today we are discussing the subject of financial abuse in divorce cases, which is a very interesting concept. Let me just hear from you, Leanne. What have you heard from clients when those two words are shared with you, financial abuse?
Well, I've found that it's a somewhat common problem, unfortunately. So I've had a number of clients, both past and even present, that have experienced financial abuse. And it can take, a variety of forms. But, often it arises in a situation where one party was the main breadwinner and, was in charge of the family finances and paying the bills and the cash inflows and outflows, and the other party played a different role in the relationship. Perhaps they tended to children more and ran the household, and so that person was unfamiliar with a lot of the family finances. And so when they came to see me for separation or divorce, they felt that they were at a disadvantage right from the get-go by not having that information as readily available, or even an understanding of that information as much as the other party. So it's something that I think comes up often enough, unfortunately. And I find too, it's often found in cases where, it's found in cases where there's other forms of abuse, not necessarily physical abuse, but often where there's, verbal or emotional abuse, financial abuse is usually tied in there as well.
It's funny that you say that. Just as you're saying that out loud, I'm going right now to the Divorce Act for the definition of family violence. I'm just curious to see if the word financial is in the definition of abuse.
I think it is, yes, but I'm interested to have you double check.
It says that right now, it says family violence means, and it's got this long list, and then it says, and it includes financial abuse. Yeah. So there you have it. So it's in our federal legislation. And for those of you that follow me online, I had created a document called BFLG's Financial Disclosure Checklist. So if you were to go to my website and you would go to Helpful Links and you were to click BFLG's Financial Disclosure Checklist, you'll see I've provided some quotes of what some judges have said about the subject of financial abuse from as recently as 2021, when the Supreme Court of Canada commented on the necessity of full, frank, and complete financial disclosure. And they, in the past, have used some very harsh language to describe situations where people do not make full, frank, and complete financial disclosure when they split up. And in fact, one judge out of BC, which has been repeated by the Supreme Court of Canada, has called financial non-disclosure the cancer of family law. Pretty strong hyperbolic language. So what is this thing called financial abuse, and what does it look like when we see it? Well, I'll tell you what it looks like when I see it. It starts with just not sharing any information about one's personal finances. Now, there are many marriages where one spouse is completely clueless about the family's financial situation. Historically, that would have been the wife not knowing about what the family owns, who owns the house, how much equity is there in the house, what are the monthly bills, what are the family's assets and debts. I've had many cases over the years where one spouse didn't even know that there's a significant amount of debt that is outstanding by the other spouse, oftentimes the husband. I had a case just recently where a client contacted me and said that I'm about to have a really difficult conversation with my ex because we've been together for 30 years and I made some really bad financial decisions. And I know once I share this with him, he is going to want to break up, and I want to know how bad are things going to be for me because of that. So I'm always surprised to hear, but that there are these relationships out there where they share everything. They share a bed, they share children, they share a house, they share vacations, but they don't share details of their personal financial circumstances. And that happens quite a bit. And so that's the beginning of financial abuse, because somebody is either building assets and not sharing the information, and then not sharing the information if they split up. Somebody has significant debt and they're not sharing that information, and then they share that information upon separation. Lo and behold, the spouse is now on the hook for a portion, if not half of that debt, because it's going to come out of joint assets, because of course debt on the date of separation is equalized until of course it becomes a sub-zero number, in which case the Family Law Act doesn't allow negative numbers to be shared. But if there's assets and there's significant debts, it certainly shrinks the amount of equity that's going to be shared with the other spouse. So financial abuse falls into not sharing assets, not sharing debts. And then after they split up, financial abuse takes on a different flavor. And that's where they withhold information, or they release information, but they release it in little drops. So it actually is very aggravating and very costly for the person that is entitled to that disclosure up front. And so we've had the Supreme Court of Canada and all the courts below them deal very harshly with financial non-disclosure. We've even had some judges make orders for financial disclosure and then say, for every day that it's not given, there's going to be a penalty paid to the person that's entitled to that financial disclosure. And in some cases, these penalties have grown into the thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. Much like if you don't pay a bill, you get sort of penalties on it. Same with financial disclosure. Now, that's the extreme case. That's very, very rare. But normally happens is where there's no disclosure, the case goes to court. And then once it's in court, you get orders for disclosure. And if somebody doesn't make it or makes it difficult, you could see costs and further orders for disclosure. And in some cases, you can get orders for disclosure directly from third parties, like from banks. The Family Law Act has a provision that allows somebody to get an order against an employer for the release of information about their income. So there's all these remedies to deal with financial non-disclosure, but it stems from the very get-go. And one of the things that I've learned after 30 years of this is the more you say no to financial disclosure, the more expensive a case is, and the more distance you travel to get to a settlement. And the more distance you travel to get to a settlement, the more expensive the settlement is. The more you say no, the more suspicion the other side has. So one way to deal with this at the front end is just to clobber the other side with whatever disclosure is feasible and realistic. And if somebody is asking for things that are just completely unrealistic or not available, then you might have to go to court and let the judge know that, look, you've given what you can, you can't give any more. And then the judge will decide if that disclosure that you've given is adequate. So those are some of my preliminary thoughts on financial disclosure. And I would say that we've come across fancy language that deals with what is a realistic or reasonable request for financial disclosure. And so we found language in court orders and in judgments that use words like reasonable, accessible, probative, necessary, proportionate. You know, a very common word is proportion. Someone says, we've been married for 30 years. I want all your bank statements for every month, for every account you've ever owned, from the date of marriage, 30 years. You know, some judges would say that's not proportionate. I mean, is there going to be some iota of help coming out of that? Probably, but it's just too much. So we're not going to order that. So those are some of the linchpins when it comes to the subject of disclosure. And I'm just going to say, and then I'll pass it back to you, Leanne. if you go to my document on the website, the key case that has been cited thousands of times for financial disclosure is the decision from 2006 from a judge named Judge Perrell. And it's in the case of Boyd versus Fields, always quoted in financial disclosure cases. And he talks about the necessity of financial disclosure and how it's important and it's necessary for there to be a settlement based on full, frank, and complete disclosure. But then he goes on to say, I also observe that just as non-disclosure can be harmful to a fair trial, so can excessive disclosure be harmful because it can confuse, mislead, or distract the trier of fact's attention from the main issues and unduly occupy the trier of fact's time and ultimately impair a fair trial. And that's where, back to financial abuse, that's where somebody asks for a bank statement and instead they get delivered three banker's boxes because the financial statement, it's somewhere in there. You just need a microscope to find it. And that's another example of financial abuse.
Yeah, and I think going back to the comment that you made about requests for disclosure that come into clients, I find often, clients, it's frustrating to have to provide financial disclosure, even completing financial statements. A lot of people get overwhelmed with that. And so if they're having to provide disclosure above and beyond the minimum amount, I find a lot of people get upset about that. And going back to the comments you made, Steve, I think it's so true, is that when somebody refuses to provide something, it immediately, arises suspicion in the other side and makes them want to dig in their heels even more to get it. And so generally, I always tell my clients, I'd rather you just err on the side of, providing a lot, unless it's something completely ridiculous, or, it's going to be such an ordeal to get it, or it's a complete invasion of their privacy, and it's not something they should have to provide realistically or reasonably. I tell them, I want them just to provide it. It may be annoying, but if you don't provide it, it's just going to give the other side more of an issue to go after you. So I think it's important that people keep that in mind. And I've had cases where the other side was requesting, ridiculous amounts of disclosure and threatening to bring motions. I had a client who was self-employed and had a number of businesses, and a lot of them really didn't make any money. But on the surface, he had these different businesses, and the ex-wife was very suspicious of him and was determined that there was money there that really wasn't there. And so it became very expensive because her lawyer kept going after, wanting to bring motion after motion for a disclosure that either didn't exist or that it had been disclosed and that was all that there was. And so I think sometimes too, along that line, what I've had happen with a client as well is you have to balance sometimes off the cost of getting all of the disclosure that, ideally in a dream world you might want to have, with what you think the value of it is going to be. Because I've had situations with clients where they thought their ex might be hiding money. They're not really sure. They don't trust them. They think they might be hiding money. But, if they are, is the amount going to be enough that, the legal costs of trying to go after it and find it and get to the bottom of it, is that going to be worth the benefit of it?
And that's where the emotionality comes in, because a person that's been married to someone for many years and knows that they earn a cash income, and now they're reporting a much lower income for the purposes of settlement, it frustrates them. And it's totally understandable that it frustrates them. They're lying, they're deceiving, they're being dishonest. And the last thing the person wants is to have a lawyer say to them, you know what, it's just not worth the money pursuing it. And then they think, well, I'm going to reward dishonesty and let this person get away with it. So that's where emotionality comes in. And that's where our job oftentimes is to look at the range of cost and look at the range of outcome. And the funny thing is, once I start plugging numbers in to a child support or spousal support calculator, people will see that, you know, the difference between, you know, $60,000 and $75,000 for child support might only be like $75 a month. And for that, are they going to spend $30,000, $40,000 to prove that they've got $15,000 worth of income that they're not disclosing? So you see, that's the analysis, is can the output justify the input?
Yeah. No, exactly. It's a real cost-benefit analysis in a lot of these financial disclosure cases. But, you know, financial abuse, you know, it is something that goes on. It involves, you know, coercive control. We hear that term thrown around. And financial abuse is very much, it's a form of control. And so when one spouse is controlling and has had that control, they do continue to exert that control through the legal process by not providing full financial disclosure. And also not, you know, when they don't do that, when a couple first separates and one party, you know, isn't yet receiving child or spousal support, and the other side isn't disclosing much, you know, information and isn't paying anything, you know, that can be a real form of financial abuse, where, you know, somebody has to go and get in front of a judge on a motion for child and spousal support to get it in place because the other side is delaying as long as possible in paying anything. You know, and then what factors in there sometimes a little bit too are legal fees. You know, sometimes if one spouse has all the financial control, the other spouse, you know, may not be in a position at the beginning to pay a retainer to a lawyer. They may have the money down the road. They've got equity in the house, and when they get their equalization, it'll be there. But initially, they're struggling to even, you know, pay a retainer to a lawyer to get the help they need in order to get the money that they're entitled to. And that goes on. So it can be a very expensive process, as you mentioned, Steve, and it's, you know, it's not uncommon.
So some of the takeaways for those that are listening to us lawyers rant and rave about the difficulties of financial abuse is, when we represent somebody that wants financial disclosure, our job is to ask why. What is it that we're trying to prove? And is there a way to prove it without asking the other lawyer or the other spouse? And oftentimes there is. So first of all, there's why do we want this financial disclosure, and can we obtain it another way? If the answer is we cannot obtain it another way, we have to get it from the other spouse, then the question becomes, can we get them to sign an authorization and we'll go get it? That way they can't use the argument that that doesn't exist, or that they don't want to spend the money to try to get it. That's number two. Number three is if you ask for it and it's not there, or they say they're not going to give it to you, then ask yourself, how much is it worth to not know that answer? And if the answer is this could potentially be worth $20,000, $30,000, $100,000, now we have something to be able to say, okay, we've got a valuation of what this unknown thing could be and what it could, how it can affect. Real estate, for the most part, is there are public records. And so the real estate searches alone will not only reveal ownership of title, it'll also reveal mortgages, and the mortgage information will reveal financial institutions. And, you know, I have a case right now where somebody says they have no income, but they have a $4 million mortgage. So right away, that financial disclosure is going to be all about, why would the bank loan you $4 million if you have very low income? So there's going to be a whole conversation, but it's going to start from the public records that I was able to get. So I don't look like I'm just willy-nilly asking for documents that don't exist or are not relevant. So that's when we represent the person seeking the disclosure. Now, the easier part is when I'm representing somebody that actually has the financial assets or income and does not want to reveal the information. And that's where I have a very good conversation about the options available to not releasing the information. You could either release the information, pay me less money, settle your case quicker, and win over the mediator or the arbitrator or the judge, by you coming clean and making the necessary disclosure. Or you could make your case longer, more expensive, and potentially cause judges or mediators to take a negative look on you by withholding that information. And of course, there's a lot in between, like unreasonable request for disclosure. And oftentimes what I do now is where I'm representing the person with the financial disclosure, I don't even wait for the other side to ask for it. I put together a brief. I put together as much of the disclosure. If I was on the other side, what would I ask? Which takes us to the golden rule. You know, treat your fellow man as you'd want to be treated. Don't do to others what you would want to be done to you. Well, we lawyers are often on the opposite sides of the same issue in other cases. So we already know what the other side would ask for if I represent somebody who's in a cash business. So I'm going to go ahead and collect that information, put it in a brief, send it to the other side, and then potentially off the record say, look, the disclosure doesn't show the cash income. We both know that there's cash income. But if we can't agree on something, then a judge is going to decide this based on the evidence. And that may not go so well for the other side. So can we reach a compromise based on what the evidence is and what the evidence will never be, i.e. the absence of cash income? Is your client really going to do a lifestyle reconstruction and spend the next 3 years in court? Or can I get my client to up their offer representing some share of cash income, maybe not necessarily all of it, to get the case settled? And so these are conversations that we have all the time. Sadly, however, I can't believe this, but for 30 years, I've seen people spend tens of thousands of dollars fighting financial disclosure issues. And it's sadly money down the toilet, because oftentimes the money that they spend on experts and on cross-examinations and on motions for financial disclosure oftentimes don't add up to the relief that they thought they were going to get.
Exactly. So I think the lesson here is to take your financial disclosure obligations seriously. And if your partner or your ex-partner is not doing so, have good conversation with your lawyer about what your options are and what the cost and benefit of those options are.
Well said.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another episode.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Divorce Explained. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to head on over to Instagram and follow at Steve Benmore and at Leanne Townsend Life for more. And if you're looking for specific divorce services, you can visit benmore.com and leannetownsend.ca. We hope today's episode made you feel informed and inspired as you move along through your divorce journey. Tune in next week for Divorce Explained.